Thank you very much for your kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, let me begin with a few comments about the new task of theology in our world today. Many believe that Christian theology has become irrelevant. It has become introvert, orthodox, traditionalist, sterile. Occupied only with its own game, it has lost contact with reality. In this wide field of difficulties of theology today, there were two experiences that became for me a new challenge of theology, which can be met only through a reorganization of the theological system itself and a new reorientation of the theological endeavor. First, in conversations with modern atheists, humanists, and Marxists, one often arrives at a point where one recognizes the deep schism of modern ages. A Christian faith in God without hope for the future of the world in the past two centuries has called forth a secular hope for the future of the world without faith in God. Since Christians, the churches, and theology believed in a God without future, the will for a future of the earth has joined itself to an atheism which sought a future without God. The messianic hopes emigrated to some extent from the church and became invested in progress, evolution, and revolutions. And in the church, only a half-truth remained. We have arrived at a moment in history that provokes the question, should there now be a parting of ways in history so that faith aligns itself with the past and unfaith with the future? I think we can overcome this present dilemma only if Christians begin to remember the God of hope as he is witnessed to in the promissory history of the Old and the New Testaments, and thus begin to assume responsibility for the personal, social, and political problems of the present. Second, we today have arrived at a turning point of history. For the first time in history, something like one world is emerging. We have reached a situation where human beings can completely eradicate each other. It is thus the situation in which mankind will survive only in a new community. Therefore, today, even the historical future will not be the continuation of the past, but something new. In the past, human beings had histories in the plural, but no common history in the singular. Today we therefore have pasts in the plural. Each people, each culture, each religion has its own past. But since in the future we will either perish together or survive in a new community, we have a future only in the singular. So we have many pasts, but only one future. Therefore, past and future today no longer appear in one and the same continuum. We have perhaps arrived at a leap from the quantities of history to a new quality of history. And in a time in which the actual movement of history is beginning to reach the universal horizon of eschatology, our understanding of our responsibility in the areas of faith, politics, and ethics is still caught in the provincial thought forms of a passing epoch. In my view, it was from experiences of this kind that a movement, if it is a movement, emerged that which has been called eschatological theology or theology of hope, and which soon revealed itself as project of a political theology. Now let me explain this. Eschatology is here the doctrine of hope, the doctrine of the future for which one can hope, and simultaneously the doctrine for the action of hope, which brings the hoped for future into the sufferings of the present age. theology, as eschatology, would wish to project the universal horizon of the future in which theology and history becomes meaningful and relevant. It does not wish to substitute eschatology for theology. Moreover, the universal horizon of eschatology reveals the reality of the world as history, manifests faith in Christ as practical hope, and thus qualifies herein the past and the present as history, that is, as experimental field of the future of God and man. This leads us to an understanding of the present as the presence of the future. The present becomes the frontier where the future is gained or lost. And then traditional differences and conflicts become relative if we can find the future only together in a common effort. So either we will now all hang together or we will all hang separately. The political dimension of theology emerges from this universal horizon of eschatology. The differences between a theology of the word and a theology of culture, the conflicts between a theology of existence and a theology of world history, are relativized the more one recognizes that Christianity stands with all its powers in the dawn of the future and must therefore bring the power of the future world into the trouble spots of the present, personally, socially, and politically. In view of the universal horizon of the future, also the church finds a new companionship with the social and political institutions of society and with the movements of transformation or renewal in society. The differences between church and world become relative if both stand before that future which one traditionally has called, well, the judgment and the kingdom of God. So then the lines of separation no longer go spatially through body and soul, spirituality and secularity, faith and politics, church and world, the sacred and the profane, but are found temporally in all areas of life between the power of the past and the power of the future world. But now, which horizon of the future is wide enough in order to embrace the differences of the present and concrete enough in order to mediate them practically? Is Christian eschatology capable of it? Which changes are necessary in an eschatology traditionally oriented toward a salvation of the soul in the beyond, in order to be able to do justice to this task? Can we unfold a Christian universalism of hope which makes meaningful and relevant the political humanism of Christianity? Now, with my first point, the peculiarity of Christian theology can be defined as follows. Christian theology speaks of God historically and of history eschatologically or messianically. Well, Christian theology speaks of God historically. It speaks of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, of the Father of Jesus Christ, and unites the proclamation of God with the memory of historical persons. It speaks of the God of Exodus, as in the first commandment, and of the God who raised Jesus from the dead, as in the Easter Kerygma, and unites with faith in God the memory of historical events. So the hermeneutical starting point of Christian theology is the concrete history as witnessed to in both the Old and the New Testaments. Christian theology speaks of history eschatologically. For it proclaims the God of Abraham as the God of the promise, in whom all nations will be blessed. It proclaims the Father of Jesus Christ as the one God of all peoples, and as a future of every creature groaning in travail. So in making present of history, Christian theology anticipates simultaneously this one universal future for all men and all things. The all-embracing horizon of historical theology that gives meaning is the end of all things or the future of history, these visions of ultimate concern. It seems to me that this unity of particular history and universality, of specific memory and all-embracing expectation, is a peculiarity which we find only in Jewish and Christian thought. As long as this dialectical unity can be retained and meaningfully represented, Christian faith is alive. If this unity breaks down, the Christian faith breaks up into a merely historical memory, on the one hand, and new experiences of the absolute or the universal on the other. So we have already now a sterile fundamentalism on the one side, and perhaps a no longer Christian philosophy of religion on the other side. Now the present crisis of the idea of God has come about because the old forms in which the divinity of God had been understood and merged with the thought and the life of a particular time have lost their self-evidence. The first form of Christian theology was the union of the sacra doctrina, that is, of the biblical tradition, with cosmological metaphysics, that is, the prima philosophia. Here, the cosmological proofs for the existence of God, in which the divinity of God and his presence were brought into an analogical relationship to the experience of the world accessible to everyone, have lost their persuasive power. Since modern man no longer understands himself as a part of the cosmos, but has placed the world as material of his scientific and technical possibilities over against himself. So he no longer lives in the house of ordered being, but more in the open history of a technical transformation of the world. The old cosmological theistic worldview, which spoke of God in relationship to the cosmos of the natural world, is antiquated and is therefore experienced as mythical by man who has become the master of his environment. But I think it is a naive pathos of the Enlightenment to discard the fundamental question which was to be answered by the old worldview. Behind the cosmological theistic worldviews lies a real misery of man, which expressed itself in the manifold forms of the theodicy question. If God exists, whence evil? The old worldview answered this fundamental question in the vision of the orderly and wisely steered cosmos and used the image of the divine cosmos in order to do battle against everywhere threatening chaos. Even though this answer no longer persuades today, since we experience reality as history and no longer as a cosmos, the fundamental theodicy question is still with us and is more pressing than before. For us, it has no longer only its old naturalistic form, as in the earthquake of Lisbon in 1755. It appears today in a political form as in the God question of Auschwitz. But it still is, to a large extent, the comprehensive horizon of the question of God, in which the theistic and the atheistic answers lock horns in battle. Thomas Aquinas asked the question, an Deus sit, whether God is, on grounds of an explanation of nature and its evils. And he argued on this on the basis of the cosmological proofs of God against atheism. We ask the question, an Deus sit, whether God is, more on grounds of history and its crimes, and must battle through the struggle with God in historical knowledge and political action. Following the victory of science over the mythical worldviews, the theodicy question and the debate with atheism in the context of this question leads us to the development of a political theology. Now, after the demise of the cosmological proofs for God's existence in the time of the Enlightenment, the psychological, the moral, and existential proofs of God's existence began their victorious advance in Christian theology, ostracized from cosmology by natural sciences. Christian theology became anthropology. Here, the claim of the Christian kerygma was joined to the question of human existence. While God could no longer be demonstrated as ground and Lord of the world, he was now understood as a transcendent ground of one's being in the world. Here, man's soul, his spirituality, subjectivity, personality, or selfhood became the real referent of theological thought. Now, this turn from theistic metaphysics of the world to the theological illumination of existence is an important step. The misery underlying the illumination of existence is the identity question, the question of man as to his authenticity. And the concrete initiative for overcoming the pain of this question as inherent in theology as anthropology can be regarded in the offer of faith as inner identity experience, and in the offer of love as relationship to the neighbor wherein personhood is fulfilled. The quest of man for his identity is here understood as a relevant horizon of the question of God in modern age. And the debate with atheistic humanism goes on in the horizon of this existential question. If we take a closer look at the identity question of man, we will find, however, that it cannot be answered apart from the social, political, and historical particularities of man, and not apart from his social, political, and historical identifications, engagements, and commitments. After the individualistic view of man has become obsolete, and in view of the debate with atheistic humanism, the identity question of man leads us towards a political theology. While the theodicy question for a just world cannot be answered without the justification of man in his personhood, man cannot find identity in himself without engaging his personhood in a battle for a just and human world. As regards the basis of the fundamental question, there exists, therefore, no genuine alternative between the cosmological and the newer anthropological theology. Man and world are mediated today in the realm of history, that is, in the social, political, and technological history in this field of experiments. Without humanization of the world, man will not find his inner identity. And without a solution to the identity crisis of modern man, there is no imaginable solution to the social and political crises of the world. So the theodicy question and the identity question are two sides of the same coin. Well, if we listen in this situation to the New Testament, a third dimension can speak to us, the dimension of primitive Christian apocalypticism. At this point, I'm taking over the historical and systematic thesis of Ernst Käsemann. Apocalypticism is the mother of all Christian theology. Käsemann did not mean thereby that body of ideas and writings we usually call apocalypticism, but more that peculiar questioning which combines the question of God with the question of the future of history. Pauline eschatology, as well as the book of Revelation, and in general that of primitive Christianity, is propelled by the question whether God is and when he would become God fully. This question, with its temporal component, goes beyond the Thomistic question, an Deo sit. The question of God is placed here on the ground of historical experience and defined in temporal terms, turns here into the question of his coming. It is a question whether the God of Jesus Christ is God and Lord of all men, and when he could become this God fully. The ground for this question is a contingent history of Jesus Christ. Its horizon is the future of world history, as it is expressed in the visions of ultimate concern. So on the basis of the Christ event, Christian theology raises the question of God as the question of the future of God, in which God will be God universally. Eschatologically directed toward the future of God, Christian faith in the experience of the world introduces the theodicy question: if there is Christ, whence evil? And makes conscious human suffering in view of the misery of man's godlessness and inhumanity. Eschatologically directed toward the future of God, the Christian message proclaims the new man and thus leads man into an identity crisis, that is, into conscious suffering in view of the misery of his inability to recognize his true humanity. So theology as eschatology tries to understand man together with the world historically in view of that future which both will find in the future of God. Christian theology, therefore, is itself a historical initiative. It does not indicate what was and what is, but tries to change things politically through performative language. In the painful realities of history, it upholds the hope for God's future, and in the anticipating reflection about this future, it searches for realizable possibilities to overcome the misery of history. Christian theology is therefore, even in its very language, according to the ancient terminology, Theologia Viae, theology of the way, but not yet Theologia Patriae, theology at home. That is, it is still the theory of a historical action, and not as yet the theory of the theory of God, the vision of God. For my second point, how to understand God, or how to understand the future as God's mode of being with us. If we understand the immanent reality of the world and of man historically, we presuppose that we view the transcending reality of God eschatologically. Both emerge together. The understanding of the world as an open process of history and the understanding of God as a future of history. From the God who reveals himself in the context of historical persons and events, everything that is referred to the future and is experienced in his in its historical openness. On the basis of the promises and the historical guidance towards fulfillment, the Old Testament spoke of the coming God who would bring his people out of captivity and exile and his creation out of chaos and misery into the home of his glory. The faith that God is God therefore necessarily embraces the hope that in the future of his kingdom he will come to his full identity in the world. In the modern debate between the faith in the God above us and the faith in the God in us, a third position thus enters in, which speaks of the God in front of us, ahead of us, the God of hope, the God of Exodus, the God of transformation. In the modern conflict between a theism that affirms God is and an atheism that negates God, saying God is not, eschatological theology can say God's being, that is, the kingdom of his full identity, is coming. So God is present in a way in which his future takes control over the present in real anticipations, promises, and prefigurations. But God is not as yet present in the form of his eternal presence. The dialectic between his being and his being not yet is, I think, the pain and the power of history. Caught between the experiences of his presence and of his absence, we are seeking his future, which will solve this ambiguity which the present cannot solve. Now, by future, we do not mean a faraway condition, but a power which qualifies already the present through promise and hope, through liberation, and through the ongoing creation of new possibilities. As this power of future, God reaches into the present. As creator of new possibilities, he liberates the present from the shackles of the past and from the anxious insistence on the status quo. Thus God becomes the power of the protest against the guilt that throws us into transiency and produces death, and he becomes also the ground of freedom that renews life. But now, if we understand the reality of God in the temporal and the historical categories of the future, we must conversely also unite the temporal and the historical categories of the future with a vision of God. Our traditional understanding of time puts past, present, and future as the three tenses next to each other in terms of equal importance. In temporal terms, therefore, the eternity of God is usually expressed in his presence in past, present, and future. Zeus was, Zeus is, and Zeus will be. This understanding of time balks against an overestimation of the future and finds God in the present and the past as well. Now, in the New Testament, this view of time is changed, I think. In Revelation 1:4, we read, "Peace from him who is and who was and who is to come." One expects to read, "and who will be." Instead, we find a place of the future tense of einai, being, the future tense of archistai, coming. And this gives the future a new dominance over the other tenses of time. Future is the coming of God. And therefore, future is the creator of time. Therefore, conversely, future is expected from the coming God. So what God was in the past and what he is in the present becomes understandable from the announcement of his ultimate coming. As the coming God, one may say that he is not only the future of the present and of the future horizon of present experience, but also the future of the past. We can therefore grasp history as a process of this future. Even so, there remains a difference between eschatological theology, which speaks of the coming God, and teleological metaphysics and process philosophy, which speaks of the becoming God, or of God as the finis ultimus, the final end of all things. As far as I can see, process theology on the one hand speaks of the becoming God in the context of the dynamics of the world process. Eschatological theology, on the other hand, speaks of the coming God in the context of the dialectical dynamics of the negation of the negative, circumscribed by the symbols of creatio ex nihilo and justification of the godless and resurrection of the dead. Now, which understanding of history emerges out of the hope in the coming God? First, God and promissory history. The new is never completely new. A dream always precedes it, says Ernst Bloch. Correspondingly, the future of the coming God is never pure futurity. It is preceded by a history of promises and anticipations. Israel experienced the reality of God in its history of Exodus, covenant, and promise. So the Old Testament is a history book rather than a book of law and cult, since law and cult have been integrated into the covenantal history of the promises. But what is a promise? A promise announces a reality which has not as yet arrived. But in announcing this future, the future becomes word present. And this distinguishes a promise from a mere prediction. If the promise brings the future into the present in the word, it compels the present to decisions. No one will see the land of fulfillment if he does not start seeking it. This distinguishes the Old Testament promises from Cassandra's oracles of fate. The Old Testament promises are historical because they open up a history through hope and Exodus. The language is a performatory language, not a constitutive. But how are the future and the presence of God in the tension of this promissory history to be understood? I think we can differentiate here between a presence of God on the way and the presence of God at the goal of the way of promises. So God's presence is experienced as fire and cloud in the Exodus and is sought in the homeland of his identity in which the Exodus terminates. So one can distinguish of a presence of a will of God in history and as history, and the real presence of God in the end of history and as its end. The historical epiphanies of God, of which Israel could truly speak, were particular and transient epiphanies. Therefore, memory transformed them into signs and promises of the ultimate and eschatological epiphany of God at the end of history. the future-oriented concept of the presence of God in his promises is not directed against concrete religious experience of the presence of theophanies, but actually preserves it in the memory of hope. Because an ultimate future announces itself in a provisional past, hope exists in the mode of memory, and memory in the mode of hope. Now, if we understand now history more generally as promissory history, we discover a profound difference which is experienced time and again in messianic religious movements and in the movements of history at all. This is the difference between hope and experience, between vision and reality. And this is, I think, the core of the so-called delay of the parousia in early Christianity. Israel set out to find the promised land flowing with milk and honey, but it found Palestine, that was threatened by both internal and foreign foes. Jesus proclaimed, according to an ironic as well as profound dictum of Alfred Loisy, the kingdom of God, but what came was the church. Now, the French Revolution promised freedom, equality, and brotherhood, but its progeny was the age of the bourgeoisie. The Socialist Revolution nurtured the expectation of the all-human society, but in effect produced a hierarchy of specialists and functionaries. The Industrial Revolution promises peace and humanity, but we find ourselves today in the midst of an irrational dynamics of civilization. All of this points to the difference in which we experience history. In fact, it is precisely this difference which propels history. On the one hand, hopes are greater than the fulfillment of reality, and history falls short of hope. On the other hand, the new reality necessitates a new interpretation of hopes. We find this alternating process of realization and reinterpretation quite evident in Israel's history of traditions, and moreover, we should keep it in view in order to proceed between the promises of history and the disappointments of history with patience and perseverance. Now the second point, God and Christ, how to understand Christ in this horizon. In the horizon of hope in the coming God, we confront Jesus, his mission and history, again with the ancient messianic question, are you the one who is to come? And thereupon we will discover that the messianic claim of Jesus lies in the prolepsis of his proclamation of the kingdom, in the antitheses of the Sermon of the Mount, in the Beatitudes, and in the call to discipleship. Jesus represents through his own presence and mission that not yet realized future of the kingdom in which God is God, and that he himself announces the arrival of this future. He brings already eschatological freedom into the misery of the present. It is congruous with the eschatological proclamation of the historical Jesus that the Easter witnesses proclaimed the crucified one as the messianic or eschatological representative of God on the basis of his Easter appearances and found in him the focus of universal hope. Just as his proclamation could be repeated in the light of Easter, and just as Easter became the ground of a new hope on the background of his proclamation, so one could recognize in him the real anticipation of the future of God. with his mission and proclamation and the Easter event, the ultimate liberation of the world is set into motion. If we see Jesus, his proclamation, and his history together in the concept of the Christ event, we find in this event two perspectives. One, in this event there lies a real anticipation of the future of history in the midst of history. For this reason, the early Christian community gave Jesus messianic titles and characterized his end with the eschatological expression raised from the dead. The eschatological future of God, of life, of righteousness, and the new creation occurred in history and under the conditions of history through him and in him. Therefore, memory of him can become the ground of world-surpassing hope. Nevertheless, the early Christian community kept in mind the distinction between Jesus the Lord and God himself. In the worship of the New Testament community, one prayed only to God, never to Jesus the Lord. Rather, the Lord was called upon. So we have access to God through the Lord and can pray to God in his name. We again find this distinction between God and Jesus the Lord in the reflections of 1 Corinthians 15. God has delegated his lordship to Jesus for a definite time and for a specific purpose. At the consummation of that purpose, Jesus will return his dignity so that God will be all in all. I think the meaning of these observations is that the finality of faith in Jesus as the Christ of God was linked up with a provisionality of hope in God himself. The lordship of Christ in a world of sin and death is a provisional and messianic realization of the ultimate lordship of God. Seen from this perspective, the purpose of Christ's lordship is to make room for the absolute lordship of God, or for the identity of God in the world. Thus we find in many parts of the New Testament a eschatological or messianic Christology. Therein Christ becomes the precursor, the placeholder, the representative of the coming God. On the other hand, however, there is inherent in the Christ event a real incarnation of God's future. Eschatological Christology results only if from the particular presence of Christ one looks upon the universal future of God. Now, if conversely one looks from the future of God to the presence of Christ, one finds in him the incarnation of God. I think that we find this perspective again in the title Son of God. However much Jesus' proclamation and the proclamation of the resurrected Lord are future-oriented, one saw, on the other hand, in his passion and death, the offering up of the Son through the Father and the offering up of the Son himself. This is the movement of incarnation, of obedience, and of love. Therefore, it is not...